Welcome to this week's colloquium. Today we have Silke Weinbrunner. She got her PhD from Victoria University of Wellington, then did postdocs at UBC and CISA, and is now at the University of Nottingham. She's also a PI visiting fellow, so she's here for how long? For
2 months.
2 months, okay. Mm-hmm. And she's going to tell us about hyperdynamic simulations of rotating and non-rotating black holes.
Okay. First, thank you very much for the invitation to give a seminar here. So the topic I'm going to talk about is the idea that you can mimic some of the effects that occur around non-rotating and rotating black holes in analog simulations, so in real-life systems. So given the date, I thought I start my seminar on a little bit of a lighter note.
Do you remember when I said the similarities of the equations of general relativity and hydrodynamics suggest you could find the equivalent of Unruh radiation in a large body of water?
I thought I said that to you.
Anyway, Stephen Hawking's team is looking into that, and I've been invited to join them.
Wow, Hawking, good for you.
It is, just, you know, I'd be gone for a while.
Well, how long?
3-4 months.
Whoa. When would you leave?
Weeks.
Wow. Okay, well, I'll just come visit you.
That's the thing, you can't. I'll be on a ship in the North Sea.
On a ship? Aren't they afraid Hawking will just roll overboard?
He's not going to be there. He's just sending a team to research his theory.
Oh, sure. Like when you send me to kill spiders in your bathtub.
So luckily, you don't have to do this experiment at the North Pole. And also, this really sounds very much like a Hollywood fabrication. There's some actual truth behind that. Also, they did get some of the details wrong, of course. So let's start with the general idea. So why can you do that? So the general field of research is called analog gravity, and perhaps most of you have heard about that, but for the ones that haven't, I'd like to just tell the idea behind analog gravity in a nutshell. So it is related to a very important, outstanding problem, which is to find a quantum gravity theory. Now, behind that is the idea that you would merge quantum field theory and our theory of gravity, general relativity. Now, at an intermediate stage, you can ad hoc merge these two theories by just taking from general relativity the notion of space-time geometry. If you merge that ad hoc together, you get what's called classical and quantum field theory in curved space-time. Now, what you're assuming there is that you don't really need gravity beyond that you're taking a solution of the field equation so that you can actually describe some astrophysically relevant situations, but you kind of throw away the dynamics. But you take space-time geometry, and then you see how fields evolve on such a classical gravitational background. Now, if you, of course, also assume that you have to assume that whatever happens to your matter fields is small so that you don't have a back reaction onto the gravitational field itself, which then, of course, would involve some generativity again, some back reaction process, which then is called semi-classical gravity, where the gravitational field is classical, and only the matter fields are quantum, but you can also self-consistently solve them by including back reaction effects. So now, what this analog gravity system, so what is an analog gravity system? So these hydrodynamic simulations of rotating black holes in this analog gravity system, so where can these analog gravity systems are analogs of quantum classical field theory in curved space-time? So what is an analog gravity? So I think it was about 25 years ago, Bill Unruh found that he could look at irrotational fluid flow. Here, I wrote down the continuity equation and the Euler equation, and he looked at small perturbations in the system, and he linearized. And he found that there is a very compact way of rewriting these little perturbations in a very compact way, and that is given in this box here, which is and I will explain that in a second, a wave equation on a general curved space-time geometry. Here, this is basically an effective space-time, and what enters here is a c squared is the propagation speed of the little ripple in your fluid, and v is the background velocity flow. So what you can see here is that you can actually get effective horizon, because if this is my metric, my effective metric tensor, you can create, you can see here, what if the velocity, background velocity exceeds the perturbation speed, you can set up what's called an acoustic when you look at sound waves, or an effective horizon, for example, if you look at surface waves in the system. Now, let me just explain a little bit more about this equation he found in the fluid flow. When you look at the wave equation everybody knows, you can compactify that, introducing the Minkowski metric describing flat space-time geometry. Now, if you then ad hoc replace this metric with a generally curved space-time geometry, then you can see how fields propagate on this curved space-time geometry. Now, of course, then you can say, oh, now in this equation, I can appropriately quantize my fields, for example, using second quantization techniques and assuming some commutators. And if I'm assuming, basically, as I said before, that there's no back reaction on the gravitational field, you don't have to include any more dynamics. So, and in this sense, that is where this analogy comes from, because you can describe these little ripples precisely in this way with such an effective space-time geometry, which is governed by the background flow. So let me discuss that a little bit more in detail. So how artificial is it to assume the presence of these analog horizons? Now, if you look at the simple one-dimensional fluid flow and you look at surface waves, and surface waves are much slower than sound waves in the system, then you can actually easily set up a pair of black and white hole horizons. So a black hole horizon is a black hole has an event horizon beyond which nothing can escape. So everything can enter, but nothing can escape. The white hole horizon is the time reverse of a black hole, so nothing can enter, but everything can escape through it. So in an analog gravity systems, you naturally very easily get a pair of horizons. That's actually something very important to these analog gravity experiments, because it can also cause some instabilities, which we'll discuss later. So in this simple setup here, you look at surface waves, which are indicated with the yellow arrows, and they can, of course, in principle, go both ways. The fluid flow is going from the left to the right, and with the arrows I indicated when the fluid flow is increasing, because the conservation of mass tells us if I reduce the height of the flow, it has to flow faster. Now, if I look at the little ripples on the surface, they happen to scale with the height, they're proportional. So when you reduce the height, they're slower. Now, in this sense, it's actually fairly easy, and you have seen that actually in river flows many times, perhaps without noticing it, that you create an area here, an area here where the background velocity is equal to the perturbation speed. So if you have, if you're in this region here, the surface wave can propagate faster than the background flow. So in principle, they can go both ways. The same goes here. But in this region in between, which we call the critical region, the background flow is exceeding the propagation speed. And therefore, small perturbation can only get dragged along with the fluid flow. They cannot counterpropagate. On this point here, we're talking about the effective black hole horizon. And on this point here, we talk at the effective white hole horizon. So why are they useful? So this is a nice and neat analogy, but can we do anything with that? So I think, I mean, in my opinion, perhaps the most interesting and perhaps also the most crazy idea or aspect Bill was considering when he put out the paper where he showed this analogy was not that he could rewrite, not just that he could rewrite these equations for the fluctuations in a form, you know, in a compact way, which then is equivalent to classical field theory at that stage on curved space-time geometry. What was a bit crazy back then, the title of this was Black Experimental Black Hole Evaporation, question mark. And what he said, well, if the equation of motions are the same in this analog gravity system as they are for example, when I look at scalar fields propagating around black holes, astrophysical black holes, then, and if I capture all the important physics, then the physics, the phenomenon, the effects that occur should be the same. For example, I should see an analog of the black hole evaporation process. And he put a question mark because there's an old question around black hole evaporation that Bill was thinking very hard and deeply about it, which would also play an important role in these analog gravity systems. So I want to talk about experiments looking into two effects related analog gravity simulations that look into two effects related to black holes, one for non-rotating black holes, which is the black hole evaporation process. And if you have a black hole with a non-zero angular momentum, you also get super radiance. So, and as I said before, what they're going, these effects are all described within the field of quantum classical field theory in curved spacetime. And if you think about the problem of quantum gravity, and you think about the lack of experimental hints towards the full quantum gravity theory, already at that stage, it's very difficult, almost impossible, no, I can't say impossible, to really see these effects, to observe these effects from astrophysical black holes. Therefore, these analog gravity experiments are important to test some of the robustness, to get some insight what it actually takes to detect these effects, even in a simple analog gravity systems which we can hand-on modify. So what is the problem? Let me talk about Hawking radiation. I want to talk about two experiments, ones which I've been involved in myself, and another more recent one last year, which looks at superfluids. So first of all, what is Hawking radiation? So classically, nothing can escape from a black hole. But if I also include quantum mechanics, quantum physics, then you have, there's a process that allows black holes to evaporate away its mass. So this is a very, very important process because it tells you the final state of this black hole. Now, there's a problem, however. If you look at a black hole, there's a thermal radiation. I will explain a little bit more why black holes evaporate. But if you look at a black hole far away and you see nice thermal radiation, if you trace back this radiation back in time, then towards the horizon, you see there is an extreme blue shift happening to this radiation. And the blue shift is extreme, to an extent where perhaps one could think that it's not so sure anymore that you should trust that quantum field theory in curved spacetime is a valid description, and that perhaps you really need a full quantum gravity theory to understand what's going on. Now, in these analog gravity systems, there's a similar situation, which is that if there really is such an extreme blue shift, so I have a notion of effective horizons in there, as I will discuss later, you can actually mimic this process, but the question is, if I have this blue shift and go to shorter and shorter distances, at some point the equations of motion I described, my fluids, which were the Euler equation, continuity equation, and so forth, these are all effective equations. Of course, I know that water exists of water molecules, so at some point I shouldn't trust these equations anymore. And also already at the level where I trust these equations, there are at shorter distances in this system, it's a dispersive media, there are differences. So the main question here is not just to set up a nice experiment, but to experimentally test how robust this process is and if it really depends on what's happened at short scale. So I want to discuss two experiments, as I mentioned already. The one we carried out at the University of British Columbia in 2011, looking at fluid, in fact, looking at the same system where I described the black and white horizon. And then I want to talk about superfluids. And I also want to say, OK, now I have a fluid flow which is so cold that, in principle, I could eliminate all the other noise sources, like thermal noise, so that I could actually access quantum fluctuations in this system. And can you actually really, there's a difference between, can I see some quantum traces? So that's why it's important to go to superfluids. But I'm jumping ahead a little bit. I have to talk about the classical equivalent of Hawking radiation first. So Hawking radiation in a nutshell. So you want to observe this effect. So you have to have a good understanding, a good handle on what is Hawking radiation, which then also tells you how you can set up an analog experiment to measure that effect. So let me just give some very more or less philosophical, perhaps a very, I think, not very intuitive explanation. What is Hawking radiation? So sometimes it's referred to as a pair creation process, where you have some sort of separation of particle and antiparticles, which are created from the quantum vacuum. And if you're close to the black hole horizon, those can actually be split. The negative, the antiparticle falls into the black hole, therefore reduces its mass, and the partner is getting emitted away in form of this thermal radiation. Now, that's not a very useful understanding if you want to do an experiment in a fluid. So how else could you try to understand this Hawking process, for example, in a simple scattering process? So let's forget about all the fancy things from quantum fields or in curved spacetime. Let's just see what we really have. So the gravitational field is a potential. When you have a scalar field propagating on it, it gives you a potential, a modified potential. Now, what you can have the boundary here. It's a special boundary. This is our black hole horizon, but it's just a boundary condition you're putting onto this potential, which is that no mode can escape. That's what it is. So you just have absorption. Outside here, so this is my gravitational potential, of course. It's finite, but still, so there is an effect of this gravitational potential, and then I have the boundary. So here on this, I have small fluctuations. At that point, I don't make an assumption if they're classical or quantum or whatever, but I have fluctuations. So now, of course, if I reduce the problem just to radial direction, I say I have ingoing and outgoing, or if you look at the picture here, right or left moving modes. Now, in principle, you have them on both sides, but remember, I have this very special boundary condition here, which means, let me also, before I apply the boundary condition, sorry, let me just write it in a different way in a scattering process. So if I find a conserved quantity that describes this effect, then I can say whatever goes into the potential has to come out again. So in fact, there is such a conserved quantity. So let me, in this working with this conserved quantity, I can rewrite this process in this simple scattering process, say whatever goes in comes out again. So the conserved quantity is a particle current, which you can compute with the field, the amplitude, the frequency, the lab frequency, not the co-moving frequency. And here, this is the group velocity of the mode evaluated at certain points. So this is a conserved quantity, which you get from the equation of motion for your fields. Now there's a special boundary condition. And this boundary condition says that actually nothing is coming out. Remember, this is a black hole horizon. And if you put everything together, what you will see from this calculation is if I normalize whatever goes in to one, and I look at my process here, I see actually that it's an amplification process, because alpha squared here, what's coming out, has to be larger what I'm sending in, because this guy here has a negative sign. So it enters with a negative sign, so it looks like it's sourcing this process. And this is the whole mystery about it. So in some sense, to have negative particle current going into the black hole, and that reduces its mass. And because of this, because it's conserved, this has to be larger than one. It's an amplification process from the quantum vacuum. So now, why can I associate a black hole temperature to this? If I compare how much is coming going into and how much is coming out, I look at the ratio, I can see that I can write that e to the minus 2, and then it's just the frequency here of the mode which I'm considering, divided by the surface gravity at the black hole horizon. That's what Hawking found. And you can compare that with the Boltzmann distribution. And in this sense, you can associate a temperature to the black hole. So it's a ratio between how much is falling into the black hole and how much is coming out. So now, the statement I'm making now is very important for analog gravity experiments. These black holes, these analog black holes, are classical, and also real black holes in principle are classical and quantum field, field amplifiers. So it doesn't matter whatever is there. If you have a thermal radiation or whatever, it would take this and it would amplify it, as long as you're in the linear regime of the amplifier. So how does black hole work? So again, it is a pair creation process. it follows a Boltzmann distribution, and this Boltzmann distribution has to be linked to the surface gravity at the effective black or white hole horizon. Now, this is what you have to show in order to show that you have seen Hawking variation. Ah, sorry. Now, so the way it works, this is a very strange amplifier. It doesn't have any power plug. It basically it takes its own energy, saved in terms of its mass, and it slowly evaporates it away. And while it becomes smaller and smaller, it gets hotter and hotter, it radiates more and more till it finally completely has evaporated away. Now, so what I'm going to say is usually if you think of what's all there, if I have, for example, I have any system can be a superfluid, for example. If I have a superfluid, I can excite waves in this. I can shake the trap. If I don't do that, so I still have some classical noise. There's still some vibrations, perhaps from the trap or so, whatever. So I have classical noise. If I reduce that, I'm down to thermal noise. If I can further reduce that, I'm basically down to the limit where the quantum fluctuations, which are always present, but at that stage, at that limit, where they are dominant. Now, and what people, when I talk about Hawking radiation, usually would say, well, somewhere here, when the thermal noise is sufficiently reduced that a quantum noise is really dominating, then you can talk about a spontaneous amplification, spontaneous Hawking radiation. But in analog gravity systems, right, there is, of course, I can also excite a wave. That's precisely what we do. So you can also ask, can I actually test or drive this amplifier with a much higher amplitudes in the classical regime? And this is what we call the spontaneous Hawking radiation. What you cannot expect when you do something like that clearly is you cannot expect any quantum correlations. But it turns out this is really, really hard anyway. And even in superfluids, it is very, very hard. And people have done experiment for cosmological particle reduction and 10 to the minus 6 Kelvin, and they got a completely classical result. Because what it means to test to see something quantum, that's another level of difficulty. And that's only in these analog gravity systems. So I think this gives you also a little bit of an idea how hard it really is to see quantum gravity effects. So now let's go to these two examples first. So the first one is the one with the fluid. With Bill, here's Bill Bilano, then there is Greg Lawrence, Ted Tedford, and Matt Penrose. So this is our setup, very old style. I liked it very much about these experiments. What you have here, you have this water reservoir. You fill it up, then you switch on a water pump. You get a flow circle here till you get a stationary flow. You have an obstacle emerged in this flow, which reduces the height. And as explained before, you get this set of black and white hole horizon. Now, as I explained, I hopefully convinced you as well, that if this amplifier can, I mean, it's amplifying quantum noise, quantum fluctuation, but you can also operate it actually, not just, you can operate it at much higher amplitudes, you can stimulate the system. This is what we're doing here. We have waves. Because we're stimulating the system, it turns out it's easier to stimulate the system in the right way to get the process at the white hole horizon. Now, as long as the white hole horizon is stable, the Hawking radiation works the same, the calculation for the white as for the black hole horizon. And in this particular case, they are stable. Now, what we did, frequency by frequency band, we stimulated that. We sent a wave into this white hole horizon, and we saw what's happening to it. And what we see is here we have a frequency band which we're exciting, 0.185 hertz. We're sending in a long wavelength into this horizon, and once it hits the horizon, it cannot propagate further. It gets, it converts to two waves, gets converted into two waves, these two. This is this pair creation process. You can calculate the particle current for these two waves. You can show that one of them has carrying a negative particle current, the other one is carrying a positive particle current. So it is a pair creation process. Now, what you can also show, next thing you wanna, it's not enough just to show that there is a pair creation process. There are many pair creation processes. You have to make sure that this is a pair creation process which is described by the surface gravity at the effective black hole or white hole horizon. Now, the first thing you want to see is because, as I mentioned before, what is Hawking radiation is if beta omega, the guy with a negative particle current versus the guy with a positive particle current. So the guy that goes into the black hole and this is coming out is x minus 2 pi omega, the frequency of the modem considered, gh here, a constant. So what it means is if omega goes to 0, this should go to 1. If omega gets larger, then this gets further and further suppressed, and you have less conversion to the negative particle current partner. Thank you. So this is, you can already see that here. You can look at different frequency bands. This dashed line gives you noise level in our experiment, and you can see that if you go to, this is the positive particle partner, these are the negative ones, and you can see with increasing frequency, less and less gets converted to the negative norm partner. So now, of course, there are some difficulties here, which is that you cannot wait far, far away for this wave to be on flat spacetime, which would be a uniform flow again, constant height. You cannot wait for the waves which are being created to propagate away because actually a dissipation in the system. Luckily, what you're interested in, the ratio between the positive and negative norm guys and their dissipation is the same roughly because they're roughly the same wavelengths. And therefore, it cancels out, so you don't really have to take it into account. But what you can't do, you cannot evaluate this Hawking radiation, in a sense, far away from the effective vital horizon. But what we can do, we can still look at this conserved quantity, and instead of just looking at the peaks of these guys here, you see that they're spread because the background is still changing, so that's not uniform, so you have a change in the wavelength. But you can actually integrate over this area after some sufficient or appropriate coordinate change. And what we expect actually is, if I take the log of these guys, I expect that then this just an omega is just a slope. And this is what we get here. And now the last thing one has to check independently, if this slope, which is the surface gravity, which I can get from the fluctuations, if I compare that to the surface gravity, which I can get by just looking at the fluid flow, if they match, and they match within experimental errors. So now that's all nice, but in the meantime, the field has moved on. And one particular effort has been to say, OK, fine, we have seen this effect in fluids, but what we really want to do is quantum fields during curved spacetime. So if you want to see some quantum effects, clearly you cannot take a fluid flow. It turns out that actually the temperature, if I remember, if you were to associate to this line in our experiment, the temperature, it's 10 to the minus 12 Kelvin. It's even lower than in real black holes. There's just no way you could see any quantum effect. Could we perhaps switch off the lights a bit more? Or I think it's OK. Thank you. That's fine. Thank you. So, and one experiment which I'm quite excited about came out last year. And that's by Jeff Steinhauer. And he looked at Hawking radiation in superfluids. And because this effect, again, if you calculate the actual temperature, is very, very small, it's very, very hard to actually see the quantum, the amplification of the quantum fluctuations in your superfluid. But he used a trick so that you can see something which initially, as he claims in the paper, was an amplification of the quantum fluctuations can be amplified and amplified and further amplified till the amplitudes are large, which means, of course, you're losing somehow the quantumness of this effect. But somehow you can argue that this is something which really is associated to the spontaneous emission. So what he's using, the trick is called, he's building a black hole bomb in a superfluid. So how did he do the experiment? In fact, the experiment is very similar to the Vancouver experiment. Just instead of having the water flowing over the obstacle, he takes an obstacle and pulls it through the flow. So he has a BSE addressed, a superfluid addressed, and he creates using a large diameter Gaussian laser beam, which he's just moving through his condensate. So it's the opposite idea. We could have also, in some sense, if you had done the Vancouver experiment by keeping the water still and just moving the obstacle. The advantage is if you move the water, you can do the experiments longer and longer and longer. So he did that here. He shows that he compares here, these are the flow velocity versus the sound velocity that he really has a supersonic. Here he looks at sound waves, not surface waves, a supersonic region. He calls the one a black hole horizon, the other one inner horizon. It's just, again, black hole and a white hole horizon. So in superfluids, the difference to the surface waves is there's a different dispersive media. In superfluids, it's subsonic. In fluids, it's for the surface wave, it's subsonic. For the in Bose-Einstein condensates, it's supersonic. And when you have this effect, you can have what's called a black hole laser effect. So because the thing is a super, because perturbations are supersonic, so the negative frequency, the Hawking partner, can actually enter this critical region and can be amplified multiple times. And so it's an instability, a dynamical instability. So it gets larger and larger and larger.
So would that happen in like a regular black hole if you have supersonic propagation as well or not?
Well, the thing is you have two things you need. Like you also need another boundary. I mean, you if you want to build some sort of instability.
Black holes have inner and outer horizons. So do you expect that? If you have supersonic propagation, do you expect a black hole bomb there as well?
So I think, in a sense, these black hole bombs, you also get them if you just put a mirror outside of a black hole, right?
Okay. That's obviously, okay.
So I don't know exactly how you would deal with the inside between black and white holes, I don't know. Because there's also a singularity in between. So I don't know exactly how you would do it in between black and white hole horizon in for an astrophysical black hole. But you can build black hole bombs by simply putting a mirror outside a black hole, which puts another instability.
It's not as simple as you make it.
Sure, sure, it's not, but I'm just saying it's a boundary condition you have to put on it. Yeah?
You didn't mean the black and white. You meant the two horizons in the curve space. Kind of like the...
Sorry?
No, that's all right.
No, go ahead.
I think you're talking about the two horizons of the Kerr spacetime, not like the black and white hole, like the extended spacetime diagram. Like would they? Because you would think of maybe
inner and outer horizon.
Yeah, I mean, so sorry. So what he calls inner horizon, which just in the Vancouver experiment we called it white hole horizon. I don't know why he calls it differently. I don't know. It's just this region. It's bound where you have a critical flow. Outside this region, its propagations can move both ways. I think it's more appropriate to call it a white hole horizon. Okay. So, but however, it's a beautiful, in my opinion, it's a very beautiful experiment. He shows that he looks at density-density correlations as they build up in time. And he can see that here in this density-density correlations, here is this point here is the inner horizon. This is the black hole horizon. And he indicates here with his arrows what he thinks is basically the self-amplified Hawking radiation. Again, of course, when the effect gets big, which is beautiful to see it, you lose a quantum feature. So I perhaps recommend you, because I don't have so much time, to read through this paper carefully. It's very interesting, in my opinion. So the rest of my talk, I want to talk about the new experiments which I'm doing and the things, the system I'm studying over the last few years, and tell you what the experimental stages are, what stage I am, and also some of the theory insights why I think this experiment can be done. So now I'm looking at something a little bit more challenging. I'm looking at rotating black holes. So rotating black holes are black holes with a non-zero angular momentum. That sounds like a trivial extension. In fact, it's a much more complicated geometry where exhibit many, many horizons, outer, inner horizons. Important for what I want to do are two horizons. And these are the outer, the ergosphere here, and the outer black hole horizon. And within this region, you can have what's called frame dragging. And associated to this region, you get a new effect, which is called super radiance. And I will talk about the super radiance effect, which is the effect that allows a rotating black hole to evaporate away its angular momentum, or to lose its angular momentum. It's a classical effect. Now, how can I get that in an analog gravity system? So now, obviously, I cannot just take a one-dimensional open channel flow. Again, I'm looking at surface waves in water, but this time, I'm looking at vortex flows. And what I have here, I have a two-dimensional velocity field, I have an angular velocity, and I have a radial velocity. Now, I can define a point here where the total velocity equals the perturbation speed on the little ripples, so like the surface waves. So once a surface wave enters this region, it cannot counterpropagate. It gets dragged along with the rotation of the fluid flow. However, it may still escape because it's the radial velocity is not exceeding the propagation speed. The way I define my effective horizon here, effective black hole horizon, is when the radial velocity of the flow is equal to the propagation speed of the surface waves. So I think that's a little bit more easier to understand. So in fact, the first paper, I did my PhD with Matt Wieser in New Zealand, and the first project was to see what can you mimic in an analog gravity system. Can you mimic actually the Kerr solution? So if you assume some very strange flow behavior, not the natural one if you have a stationary draining flow, but if you would look at electromagnetic dynamics flows or so, then what you can see is that you can actually mimic not all of a Kerr black hole, but you can mimic the equatorial slice. And the equatorial slice for a rotating black hole is where this area, in some sense, the distance or between, it's a bit loose, distance between the ergosphere and event horizon is maximum. So that's sufficient. Once you have this region, then you can look at this effect, which I'm interested in, which is super radiance. So what is super radiance? So if you have a black hole, you have an angular velocity, you can also have a charged black hole. For us, it's not so interesting. But a super radiance process, again, is an amplification process. Difference being to a black hole, I can point the black hole evaporation process. I can point it out in a second. But it's a similar process where if I send in a wave, I would stimulate. This is really classical. If I stimulate a wave propagating into this rotating black hole, it gets reflected, it escapes. But again, there's a similar process. It actually, one enters the black hole, a rotating black hole, and the other one gets radiated away. And the reflected wave here, if one is sending in, you can see if omega is smaller, like m, it's the anti-Moutel number of the wave which I'm considering, and this is the angular momentum of the black hole at the horizon, then I can see that indeed this changes sign and I can have an amplification process. Now, again, we can look at the scattering process in the same way as I said before. Here again, difference being is that not all of these partners which are ingoing here is that not all of them have a negative sign. It depends where omega has to be small enough. So this is an effect bound from above. So only low frequency modes are being amplified. And what you're sending in are long wavelengths, and long wavelengths are coming out. Hawking radiation is a different effect. It actually only takes short waves and converts them into very long wavelengths. And this is also why it doesn't make so much sense for astrophysical black holes to talk about the stimulated black hole emission, because if you're at these very short wavelengths, there's not much more there than quantum fluctuation, because even thermal fluctuations are very much reduced. While, of course, here in this regime, when you're sending long wavelengths, then, of course, also makes a lot of sense to think of the classical equivalent of it. So this is what this effect is. Oh, sorry. OK. So one of the things we looked at, so part of this talk is to just say, what are all the steps, the series steps we've been working on to make sure that you can actually see this effect in this particular analog gravity system, which I'm interested in. So one of the things any analog gravity system, as I said before, has is a dispersive media. So one of the things you can do, you can say, what if I look at this scattering process and I include dispersion, subsonic and supersonic? And one of the things you can show, well, if you have dispersive media, what it means, for example, if I have water and flowing at them with a certain speed and I have a wave generator, I can not only excite right and left moving long wavelengths, I can also excite short wavelengths. So in some sense, I can excite more fluctuations, different kind of fluctuations. In a sense, perhaps not very accurately, but you could think of more propagating degrees of freedom. So if you have a scattering process, then you could also scatter into those. So if you want to define, include all of these other modes, you would have to generalize your scattering process. And you would have to say, well, as long as more is coming out as what I'm sending in, I still have a super radiant, super radiance amplification process. And also, of course, how much you scatter to this extra channel, you can suppress it. So you can also play this, but in general, you have to be aware of that these are much more complicated scattering processes. So we have analyzed that, and things are indeed looking quite good. So now, one of the things also is to understand really what is super radiance and how does it compare to other similar situations such as a Celdovich cylinder. So one of the things we also did, we generalized this process and said, so when does super radiance occur? So again, if you think of scattering processes and say, if I have a potential, what requirements, boundary condition, potential do I have to fulfill in order to have super radiant scattering? So one of the things you can include is actually dissipation as well. As long as if you go to xi is now my new variable here, I'm assuming that my field here only depends on one coordinate, for example, the radial coordinate due to symmetries, then you can say as long as this potential vanishes, as xi goes to infinity, and as long as xi times the complex part of my potential is going to zero, you can actually generalize this process and can ask, when do I always get amplification, a super radiance amplification, which means that the reflected part is bigger than the ingoing part. Now you can show actually there are two effects. So one is around rotating black holes, which is because of this boundary condition. If you were to have not such a strict boundary condition, so they say it's not completely absorbent, so nothing can go out of the black hole, you can still get super radiance as long as more is coming out as it's going in. Another case where super radiance initially has been predicted was a rotating cylinder. It's called Celdovich cylinder. And this is simply an infinitely long cylinder with a radius r rotating in a vacuum and a spatially uniform. Spatially uniform has permittivity, permeability, and electrical conductivity. And there you can also get super radiance in this scenario. And here this is due to dissipation. So this is due to the dissipative part in the potential. So there are two ways of getting super radiance. One is simply this boundary condition, this absorbing boundary condition, some mechanism which takes away the negative particle current modes, or that you can dissipate it away.
Okay, question. So is the idea that this is like some dielectric cylinder? That's yeah. Rotating and then light, you shine light at it, yeah. And then it comes back for a curve.
Sorry, I shouldn't have explained it better. So in the one case, in rotating black hole, it's the boundary condition, and the other one is dissipation. So I'm setting up two experiments at the moment. One is, this is basically set up, and that is really to just look at super radiance related to the special boundary conditions, so in the presence of an effective black hole horizon. And the other one is actually, can I do something similar to what Jeff did in some sense? Can I set an acoustic bomb? Can I have some sort of dynamical instability? Also where I look at dissipation and other things. So this one here, I will now talk about the setup in the following. And this thing here, we've just completed more or less the theory behind that. Main collaborators are Victor Cardozo, Maurizio Ricards, and Antonin Cotin. On this side here, this I have started setting up 2-3 years ago, but I just recently moved this experiment from Italy now to Nottingham, to the UK, and I'm working together with Joseph Nimella, Stefano Liberati, Maurizio Ricatz, and Ted Tedford. So the setup is basically a gigantic bathtub vertex flow. This is a picture of our setup. And the question is, what does this have to do with a rotating black hole? So if I have some sort of stationary draining flow, how big is the effect that I can expect? So that's the most important question when you want to observe it. It's not just this effect there. How big is it? So of course, I'm assuming, as I said, there are three free parameters in principle, which is my angular velocity, b is just a constant. I'm assuming an irrotational vertex flow. Outside the core, this is a very good assumption. Then I have a radial velocity flow. I'm also assuming it's not quite so simple as a 1 over r dependence, because h, the height of the flow, can also change. But in principle, it's also irrotational, the radial component. And I have a height infinity. And the first thing I want to do is, one of the things we did last year, towards the end of last year, is to do a parameter space search and to understand how different and how similar this analog black hole is to a real astrophysical black hole. So what we did is actually, in order to include more fluid dynamics, we actually took the fluid dynamics equation and we solved for the water profile to some approximation. And when you do this, what we realized already at that level of our approximation, you can reduce the three free parameters to 2. And that was important at the end. And one of the things which I found very fascinating is, in principle, one would think, OK, there's no upper bound on the angular velocity at the black hole horizon you're expecting, because in some sense, b here is a free parameter. B is a free parameter associated to the angular velocity. And turns out that, in fact, there is a maximum, there's an extremal black hole which you can get, which is when all the which is related to the height of the flow at infinity. And what means, if I converted the whole potential energy of the flow into angular velocity, that's the maximum angular velocity I can get out of the flow. So it's related to h infinity, not to b. And then you can also see this is a point when, in some sense, when a bar, which is associated with the radial velocity, if that goes to 0, you don't have a black hole horizon. So this is the case where you approach extremal black holes. So in the same sense, in astrophysical black holes, here is also you predict it. Yeah?
Could you show the profile for h, or is it the formula for h, the height as a function of radius?
Yeah.
So what does it do? It goes to, it actually gets a smaller at small radius?
Yeah, the profile, I don't have pictures of the thing here, but if this is your thing, it does this. So it's not that simple, because first of all, you know, the black hole is defined by the propagation speed, which of course can go to, is a function of h. So let me see when.
Because it feels to me the profile for h is the more it rotates, the thinner it gets, or the smaller should the thick the height be, and then maybe that's the limit that you have. And how fast it rotates is because the thickness cannot go below 0, or the height couldn't go below 0.
I know what you want. You want to say what the extremal black hole. So this is first of all the case when a dash goes to 0. Okay, goes to 0. So then a goes to 0, but vr. Okay, which means that I have 0 radial velocity. And then, of course, that takes away the black hole horizon. Mm-hmm. So that's this limit.
Radial velocity at some point goes to zero.
I have to say, actually, can I? This is a limit which I can. I don't trust my. This is basically, we made an approximation. When you come close to this limit, you have to be very careful, because what I said, in order to have this irrotational assumption, some of these things, I cannot be somewhere here where the height is changing too much. In other words, where anyway, I would expect that I have to take the fact that my velocity fields become rotational close to the core into account. And so I don't want to be in this regime. So we carefully have to make sure that we're operating this analog gravity experiment in a parameter regime outside then. Okay. Very good. So almost done. So what I found is very nice is, so let's say I know this is an analog rotating black hole. So I don't care about A and B. What I care about are two parameters, which are, one, the surface gravity at the effective horizon. So for this, we really calculate the velocity profile and numerical we had to solve for the location of the horizon. And then we can evaluate all the parameters, surface gravity and the angular velocity at the horizon. We call it now the normalized one because we normalize it by the maximum. So because we know there's a maximum angular momentum at the horizon, which I can get in this setup. And what we are plotting here, instead, before I had this parameter space B bar and A bar, now you're looking at these contour lines, which are simply, these are contour lines of constant angular velocity at the horizon. And these are contour lines for surface gravity. And then what I want to know is how this effect, of course, scales with it. Because usually, black holes, astrophysically black holes, they only depend of A over M. A being the angular momentum and M the mass of the black hole, only of one ratio. But these are very different. They depend already on two free parameters. They have two parameters. I cannot reduce that. That's number one. And this really is the equivalent here of A over 1. This V bar is the equivalent of A over 1. It can also only go from 0 to 1. So, but now we already have two parameters. And what we did now, for each one of these points here, I can calculate my superradiance spectra. And when you do this, for example, I can be here on a constant surface gravity, so on a line like here, and look at these points and see how the amplification process grows. And what you can see, of course, what you can see is that it gets bigger and bigger up to a point, it gets smaller, but it grows. It really depends very much on the higher the angular momentum is, the bigger this effect gets, but also how the region in which it gets amplified. So this is 1, and this is the reflection coefficient squared. So this region gets larger and larger. So you can also say, okay, what if my other free parameter, what if I keep the surface gravity constant, increase the angular? What if I keep the angular velocity constant, increase the surface gravity? It's also growing, but much less. So you can now do something. You can, on all of these points, just take the maximum, because that's what I'm interested, the maximum, and where in this frequency range the maximum is. And what you can show is really that here, what is important are actually this coloring, because it tells you that you go up to 1.6, 1.7 perhaps. And what this means is if I'm sending in a wave with 1 millimeter amplitude, I get back an amplification by 1.6, for example. Now, that, of course, we know already cannot be. Because if that would be so simple, you could see this effect with the naked eye. So, and of course, as I said before, there is a regime where I don't trust our approximation, which is basically this one. So what important is here, I have all this range here where something like an amplification of 1.1, 1.2, that's what we're aiming for to see in this experiment.
I mean, the bad stuff, they're rarely completely symmetric. They're kind of things that are asymmetric.
Well, I have a symmetric setup.
You have a symmetric, and you don't see it. Okay.
Well, it's very hard to really stimulate the right size, but I mean, 1.6, I would be really big. And I know my analysis is not valid in this regime. I know that anyway. But there is a regime which you can, takes a bit maybe longer to talk you through, but which I think I can set up. So it's not because in my particular setup, where can I be in this parameter space? But I don't, maybe I'm wrong, maybe you're right, but I don't think you can get to this parameter space. Yeah.
So how do you know that you couldn't be seeing also some kind of acoustic bomb already playing a game here?
So I kind of know that because we've done the analysis. To build the acoustic bomb, you have to have much smaller setups because you have dissipation in the system. So if you're saying you have a super radiance, okay, it's very tiny, I couldn't see it, but it propagates to the boundary and back. While it propagates to the boundary, it dissipates. So the boundary has to be sufficiently close to the horizon. So I know that because with Vitter and so on, we're designing to build some other experiment, and that's why I know roughly what the boundary is.
What I was wondering is that you've done the analysis to linear order, but if it's for non-linear effects, that you're not capturing your linearized analysis, you could already have kind of some bouncing back closer to the region where the horizon is.
So, I don't know. I can only say one thing from a practical thing. The flow so far, we set it up. And I will show the setup in a second. It's very flexible. We let it run for a long, long time. If something, what you say would be there, we would see it, right? If you wait long enough, this thing should grow, and should become very visible. And we don't really see that. But this doesn't mean anything, right? I mean, it just says from my experience, it doesn't seem to be just being like, you know, without doing anything, you will get that. If you set up the experiment in the right way, maybe a smaller one, ours is quite big, perhaps. But this is a separation. So why can't I use the same setup to see both effects? So what I said before is I'm sending in waves. First of all, you could say, okay, if it's a linear amplifier just sending larger waves, then, you know, you see better what's coming back. One of the problems is if you have to send in small waves, first of all, so that there's no back reaction in one instant, not like on a long term. And the other thing is I want to see long wavelengths. In order to resolve long wavelengths and to be able to distinguish between ingoing and outgoing, I have to have a large setup. This is a long wavelength. So the height is about between 5 and 15 centimeters height. Long wavelengths in a system would be about, there's some rough formula which actually works quite well in fluid dynamics, which is something like three up to three. Some people say 10 times the height. So you need a big setup, meaning the boundaries have to be sufficiently far away. So when you want to build a bomb, I don't think it's possible to resolve just the amplification, the linear amplification. You could only see the nonlinear one because you have to pull the boundaries in, and then you couldn't resolve the things anymore, but you could eventually see the back reaction. So the setup, I really have to wrap up. I'm almost done. So the setup we started in Italy was literally on the toilet. Then we flooded the toilet, and there was a sign the next day, bagno allegato, which means bathroom flooded, and the cleaning lady kicked us out, which was really good because then they let us do an experiment in the kitchen. And then I said, I slowly could convince Joe that he lets us into his main lab. And initially he thought we're doing some small scale experiment. I made a little paper thing, then we built it in plexiglass just to see how bad or how good the flow would be in this one. Because the idea would be, I don't want to put it on a rotating table. I give the whole thing an angular momentum the way I feed in the water. So you put in the water here and here, there's a drain hole in the center that spins, it gives an angular momentum. And I didn't want to put it on a rotating table because you have to put everything on a rotating table. And I didn't want to do that. Then from this, we built, we got technical drawings, proper ones. This was the setup. This is how it looks like now. So from something like this, it's now 3 meter long, 150 meter wide. There's a frame around it, which is 3 by 3 by 3 meters. So this is a small video about it.
Essentially, the nice way to think about our experiment is that it acts like a very large bathtub. So the vortex that forms in the center here is very, very similar to the vortex that forms above the drain in your bathtub. Hence the name for this fluid dynamical phenomenon, bathtub vortex flows. Our experimental setup is 3 meters long, 1.5 meters wide, and 0.5 meter deep. What we do is we pump water out of our reservoir located beneath the tank. The water is pumped in through two inlet arms located on opposite ends of the tank. The rate of water that we pump into the tank is at about 6,000 liters an hour.
So that's our setup. I really have to wrap up. One of the things which I'm very happy about is beginning of last year, I started a collaboration with a startup company in Germany called Enshape, and together we developed a detection mechanism, a 3D sensor, as we call it, for the surface waves, because now the real challenge is to capture very small amplitudes. And the sensor now we put in a patent application for this, and it works very well over a very large region, so we really have to push the boundaries in detecting the surface waves. So we did some very first studies here, but that's a long time ago. Anyway, so the experimental challenge, the main one to overcome, is to detect these very small waves. And I think we have found a method to do that, and I just moved the experiments up and running again. So if everything goes right, we're going to see this effect within the period, perhaps, of the next half year. So I think I should stop, right?
Yeah, that's what we have.
5 minutes?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. So one of the things which I'm quite happy about is a analysis which I recently have worked on, going to put on the archive this week. This is Antonin Cotin. He won a Marie Curie fellowship to join my group. And what we have worked out is that these are really different to black holes in some sense. They do have this region, this ergo region. They have an horizon. You can get super radiance, but they're very different. Or perhaps because also there are lower dimensional black holes, right? You can have also other effects in there, very interesting effects. And one of them is a long-range effect, which is because if I have a velocity profile of an irrotational vortex, it has a 1 over r o falloff. That's what means irrotational, the angular velocity field, also the radial one. And when you do the calculation, you look at a WKB approximation of a wave, you see that such a falloff of the angular momentum, if it falls less rapidly than 1 over r, you get a long-range effect, meaning it's not only affects the scattered wave, it also already affects the ingoing wave. And you can actually see that. So meaning the velocity field leaves an imprint of an ingoing wave, which can help you actually to probe the velocity field this way. So this is also important for us to probe the velocity field to know exactly what kind of analog black hole I have. I need to measure the angular velocity field. So you have this long-range effect. And this is actually something very nice. It is associated to the Aronoff-Bohm effect. So in the 80s, Michael Berry wrote a paper with some fluid experimentalists together, which he called Wavefront Dislocations in the Aronoff-Bohm Effect and its Water Wave Analog. And they also did an experiment, and he showed, so what is the Aronoff-Bohm effect? If I have an electrically charged particle, it has been in the Aronoff-Bohm effect, it could be shown that it can be affected by electromagnetic field in a region where the electric and the magnetic field is zero. And this comes from a coupling between the way, between the phase of the complex, sorry, of the, yeah, the phase of the complex wave function of the particle with the electromagnetic potential. So this was important in quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, because of the gauge symmetry, you cannot see this dislocation, as you can see in this water analog, that if the flow is fast enough, the angular momentum, you can see that you have extra wave fronts emerging from your vortex. And what you can measure in quantum mechanics is a dislocation. So in these water analogs, you can see both an extra wavefronts emerging, a dislocation of wavefronts, and you can also, if you don't tune these parameters to multiple of 2 pi, this alpha, which enters in this sense in the phase of the ingoing wave, then you can also see these continuities. So, but why is this important is because we applied this situation to superfluids. And why is that interesting? Because in superfluids, vortices are quantized. So that I can't take arbitrary angular momentum, so the circulation in a superfluid has to be quantized, has to be multiples of 2 pi. And usually if you have a superfluid like in Bose-Einstein condensate, you get a lattice of vortices because the energy goes, energy squared with the number, what they call the winding number of this vortex. So usually a vortex with a high winding number decomposes into winding number m, decomposes into n vortices with winding number 1. And what we actually looked at this effect, this long-range effect, this modification of the ingoing wave, and what we found in the superfluid, that when you have a superfluid flow and you test it with sound waves, that the ingoing wave, because of this long-range effect of the velocity, the 1 over falloff of the vortex lines, causes that if you go to short wavelengths, that you actually pick up the winding number. So by sending in sound waves, you can actually look at density modulations. And you can, from these density modulations, when you go to shorter and shorter wavelengths, you get these beautiful patterns which show you actually, some give you information about the background flow. So what you see here, these are lattices of vortices, here with the same orientation, here with opposite orientation. And when you zoom in and in, you get more and more information about the quantum turbulence in Bose-Einstein condensates. So also the angular momentum is very small. It's still detectable through this effect because of the way the Aronoff-Bohm effect works in these systems. So that's about it. Sorry that I took so much longer. Of course, you always have to have a summary. I think, of course, I believe that because I'm working in this field. I think analog gravity is a very exciting field of research. It's very interesting. It's very challenging because it combines all these different fields in physics. You have to be very critical because you're claiming you want to mimic something. In order to mimic something, you have to really grasp the essential features of this effect. So you have to get a very deep understanding of this effect. What I think is why it's why quite exciting, because there's so many more people now start to work on this in Bose-Einstein condensates, very good groups. So I believe there will be exciting results in the next few years. For example, the one by Jeff, I think it's just the beginning. It's going to be very interesting who is going to see the first quantum effect. I also like these rotating systems. Besides my group, there's also another group which I'm collaborating closely with, Daniele Faccio. He wants to see this in optical systems. He also tries to set that up. Another thing is what one could say, okay, and I will leave that to the last, what can you learn for quantum gravity? What is very interesting is when you do these analog gravity experiments, you take your Birrell-Davis, and you get some very nice idea what to do in these analog gravity systems. And sometimes these things have been missed. So for example, there was a new type of radiation found in optical fibers, soliton propagation optical fibers, called negative frequency radiation, which was motivated, for example, from these water experiments. And also, for example, there's this instability linked to this white hole horizon. So there seems to be some sort of, is this an instability forming, slowly forming behind an effective white hole horizon or not? An instability which is not, it stops growing at some point, but there is some deformation. So there's some sort of like turbulence linked to these horizons here. And so in some sense, this interdisciplinary research kind of pays out. Now, does it pay out for quantum gravity? I have to say, well, it will not. I don't even believe, and that's perhaps a bold statement, I don't think that any of experiments, real astrophysical experiment, I don't believe will teach us anything about that. Simply because the regime where we quantum fields are in curved space-time is applicable, there's nothing to learn about full quantum gravity. For me, full quantum gravity effect would require to have very high curvature, for example. In fact, I think that the problem of quantum gravity is that we don't have any idea how to look to see a real quantum gravity effect. But what I think, what is sometimes when you work on this and you just realize how hard it is to see quantum effects in these analogs, you start to see how difficult perhaps the overall goal is to see a true quantum gravity effect. Thank you very much.
So isn't it dishonest to motivate doing all these exercises, the analog gravity, test quantum gravity, and then typically believe that you can never test quantum gravity? So.
But I have to say, I mean, dishonest, I mean, in some sense. So why do I at all associate it to quantum gravity? I guess the reason is because quantum fields in curved space-time, in some sense, right, is considered in some step towards this problem. Maybe not some which you can go continuously through, but it's the first, the simplest way of combining some sort of gravity and quantum effects. Now, I mean, maybe you can correct me, but I would say that if you look at quantum gravity proposals, Most of them maybe give you modified gravity, classical gravity action. Maybe they say you can look at cosmology, and like do quantum gravity, you don't have a singularity, you get a bounce or so. But really, quantum gravity effects.
Well, I mean, like Poincaré Lipschitz gravity, they have infrared effects.
So you say Lorentz violations.
That could be one.
Yeah, but it's a more, you get an effective field theory.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure really this classifies so much as.
You don't call it quantum gravity.
Well, it's a long, perhaps a longer discussion, but I think, you know, like, I mean, when you do, when quantum mechanics came up, it's so successful, right? One of the big things was the particle wave duality. And this was such a beautiful experiment where you could see things just really change, right? And also, I mean, it was not just a correction, it was a tremendous change, right? So I'm saying if you can just get modifications at the level of effective field theory, it's not quite the same, I would say.
Other questions? Okay, then let's thank you again.